the subject in public.
À faire sortir publiquement un thème.
The urgent need for more concerted political action against depleted uranium is only more apparent when a new war breaks out, exposing new risks. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq. In 2003, the United States attack Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein, who continues to taunt the US despite 12 years of rigorous sanctions. At the time, I'm in Baghdad, witnessing the repeated air attacks targeting the presidential palaces with depleted uranium projectiles. It's a short-lived war. In just 3 weeks, the Americans removed the dictator. Jim McDermott is not a typical American congressman. He's one of the few who have seen war close up. As an officer, he served in Vietnam, and as a psychiatrist, he has treated some of those who survived.
Mm-hmm. This, when I was dealing,
Bush lied, because I went over to Iraq and what became Baghdad Jim, not by intention, but because I was there, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think he's going to mislead us to get us into war. And so then we did it to all the rest of the country. I mean, and Fallujah was the Basra of 91. Fallujah was where we used absolutely awesome power to destroy that city.
In 2004, the Americans are confronted with massive insurrection. The epicenter is Fallujah. To stem the revolt, the city is bombarded. A deluge of fire rains down with white phosphorus and depleted uranium munitions. Today, peace has been restored to the city of mosques, and life has returned under the watchful eye of the Iraqi army. At the new hospital, Dr. Samira Alan shows me the tragedy she has to face every day.
They born prematurely, and I mean, before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with a cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he survives. If he survives, yes.
Yeah.
Since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the cases we register, the incidence is about 14.7 per thousand live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per thousand. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from the parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium.
They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001. But he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from a strategic planning standpoint, why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. They're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great because it's really effective and it's recyclable too. I think in that situation there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium-producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the US Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones, that we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist prediction. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afr el Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they've transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap when it gets there? When they bring it there, then they put it in the ground, what do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afr el Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter-order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority, and only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
One of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
Countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create, then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use will one day have to be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by near the bands, they haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come.
That's it for this week's episode, and don't forget to share your thoughts and comments with us. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen understood that in order to establish justice, to give people their rights, to establish equality and equity amongst people, he needs to be in a position of power, because it will be very hard trying to establish these things without having the upper hand. Now Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi has been given a golden opportunity to lead and rule the Muslims after the third Khalifa, and he was pressured by the Muslims themselves to lead them. He made it very clear to them that I only will take and assume office if I establish justice on all of you without any exception. It doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter where you are from, your lineage, your tribe, justice will fall on everybody equally. There are no masters, there are no slaves. Under the government of Ali, everyone is equal, either a brother in faith or equal in humanity. No injustice, no oppression. And he did so. Therefore, in order to understand the nature of Amir al-Mu'mineen's administration and his economic and financial policies, it is necessary to learn how Imam Ali alayhi salam himself has explained the Khilafah and mastership. What position Khilafah enjoys from the religious point of view, and what benefit does it carry in its lap? So it does not come free. There are things that we need to look at. When Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi tried to explain the concept of Khilafah al-Mastership to people, in one of his speeches, he was saying to people at the time that taking oath and allegiance from them and them giving it to Amir al-Mu'mineen, he said to them from the first day, he said, "O people, I am one of you. I enjoy the same rights which you enjoy. My responsibilities are also the same as yours. Nothing can invalidate truth." Now, simply Amir al-Mu'mineen in this statement, he's trying to bring himself and the title that he assumed, which is the office, rulership, and mastership of the Muslims, he says, that position does not give me the chance or the right
to be above you or to be different from you or gives me more right than you guys do. Or my responsibilities will become any less than you. So he's basically saying to them, whether I am a khalifa, a ruler or not, that will not make a difference. I should be one of you. Now, this is in the view of Ali alayhi salam. Is this the matter with all the kings, rulers, prime ministers, presidents, mayors, and governors, and even on a smaller scale? Is that how the case is? No, of course not. When a person assumes position, he automatically gives himself a higher rank than people. He walks with a bulletproof car, with bodyguards, and he does not communicate with common people anymore. No one can get to him, and so on and so forth. So you can see the difference between them and Ali. Let us take a short break, then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we said that Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he came to power, he made it clear that he wants to rule them with justice, fairness, and equality. And there is no man higher than other. Even him, being in the position of power, he is still one of them. He enjoys what they enjoy. The same responsibilities that falls on them falls on him. Unlike the those who preceded him, where they put themselves in a position of leadership and kingship, or those who came during his time and after him, like the Bani Umayyads, who made themselves kings, and obviously they separated themselves. So you had the separation of classes, where people now, they have to bow before them, they have to give them respect, and in some cases, they have to give them complete servitude. They have to be their complete servants. But Ali alayhi salam was different, because what was in his mind is the interest of people. If you want to serve people, if you want to serve humanity, if you want to give humanity a hope and a chance to live a happy and prosperous life, you must become one of them. You have to live amongst them. You have to feel their pain and their suffering. You have to see it firsthand. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he used to walk in the streets of Kufa every single day and make sure that everything was going fine. And a lot of people, even in Kufa, they did not know it was Ali alayhi salam. So he would go around and he would advise people. He would try to make sure that people are, you know, their affairs are met and no one is oppressing anyone. So he was amongst them. He used to sit with them. He used to walk with them. He did not have any bodyguards. He did not have, bulletproof horses or caravans or what have you. No, he was as simple and normal as them. He dresses the same way they dress. Eats even much less than what they eat. Lives in something more humble than what they live in. So he lived the life of a common person. He dealt with them as a common person. He came down to their level. Anyone could come to him. Anyone could speak to him. And these are the qualities of true leaders. Those who always worry about people, the safety of people, the welfare of people, and the happiness of people, not their own. So you can see that when it comes to matters of rulership, you can see that Amir al-Mu'mineen was an exception through the course of history.
where no one did what he did. Even the just rulers and just kings, we had some of those throughout the course of history, but they never came down to the level of people. They never walked in the streets as commoners. They never dealt with people as commoners. They always referred to themselves as kings, and they are doing people a favor by applying justice. This is not Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. He was an example for all mankind until the Day of Judgment. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
In the limelight. UK exports of goods to the European Union have fallen by £20 billion compared with the last period of stable trade with Europe, according to official figures marking the first full year since Brexit. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's economic correspondent, Richard Partington. The piece is titled UK exports to EU fell by £20 billion last year, new ONS data shows. UK exports of goods to the European Union have fallen by £20 billion compared with the last period of stable trade with Europe, according to official figures marking the first full year since Brexit. Numbers released on Friday, 11th of February, by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, showed that the combined impact of the pandemic and Britain's exit from the single market caused a 12% fall in exports between January and December of last year, compared with 2018. Highlighting the disproportionate impact of leaving the European Union, exports to the rest of the world, excluding the 27-nation bloc, dropped by a much smaller £10 billion, or about 6%, compared with 2018 levels. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, compared trade performance against figures from 3 years ago, because that was the last year before distortions caused by firms stockpiling ahead of Brexit deadlines and the spread of COVID-19. Despite the disruption, the European Union remains the United Kingdom's largest trading partner. However, for the first time since comparable records began in 1997, the United Kingdom now spends more importing goods from the rest of the world than it does from the European Union. UK goods imported from the European Union were down almost 17%, or about £45 billion, compared with 2018. In comparison, imports from the rest of the world increased by almost 13%, or about £28 billion. With the European Union accounting for just over half of UK exports worldwide, economists said Brexit was serving as an extra headwind for Britain, compounding the disruption from COVID-19 being felt across advanced economies. UK exporters are continuing to lose market share, said Gabriella Dickens, an economist at the consultancy firm Pantheon Macroeconomics. Although trade levels have picked up in recent months, data from the Netherlands Bureau for Economic Policy Analysis showed that real good exports from advanced economies were 3.8% above their 2018 average in November, outpacing the United Kingdom. The hardest hit commodities recorded dramatic falls. Outbound shipments of clothing and footwear to the European Union were both down by almost 60% compared with 2018 levels. Food and live animal exports, for which more stringent border checks are required, were down almost 18%, while vegetable exports dropped by almost 40%. Shipments of cars to the European Union, heavily disrupted by global supply chain issues and by COVID, were down by a quarter. Guillermo L'Arbalestier, a trade economist at the University of Sussex, said the drop in vegetable exports was probably linked to a fall in the number of seasonal workers available to pick and process crops. More burdensome paperwork and the difficulty in exporting perishable goods in the face of extended delays at the border. Clothing exports have been affected because a high proportion of garments sold by UK retailers are made in Asia or the United States, making them ineligible for the tariffs negotiated in the post-Brexit trade deal. However, the latest figures do suggest a recovery from the worst of the Brexit damage seen in January of 2021, just after Britain's departure, when exports to the European Union plunged by as much as 40%. According to the latest figures, UK exports to the European Union were about £200 million higher in December of 2021 than the same month in 2018. But much of this was driven by an increase in wholesale gas prices on international energy markets. Business leaders have warned that border restrictions and reams of red tape have pushed up costs and added to delivery times, permanently undermining the competitiveness of British goods on the European continent. 67% of firms experienced a challenge when exporting and 72% when importing in the last month, according to the Office for National Statistics ONS surveys. There is a lot more friction on trade, which you would expect to have a more medium to long-term impact, said Grant Fitzner, chief economist at the Office for National Statistics. Meanwhile, Gareth Thomas, the shadow international trade minister, said the government has exaggerated the benefits of trade deals with countries outside of the European Union that have yet to be negotiated. Ministers are not doing enough to support our exporters in markets outside of Europe, while the deal they negotiated with the European Union has led to long lorry queues into Dover, a big increase in red tape and a significant decline in trade, Gareth Thomas said. A UK government spokesperson said British goods exports to European Union nations were 4% higher last year compared with 2020. However, as the Office for National Statistics itself recognises, the impact of COVID-19 pandemic, global recession and supply chain disruption have caused higher levels of volatility in recent statistics. It is therefore still too early to draw any firm conclusions on the long-term impacts of our new trading relationship with the European Union. We are continuing to ensure that businesses get the support they need to trade effectively with Europe.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles. From very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities, Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
there has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Talks are resumed in Vienna to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of such talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. has so far failed to remove its maximum pressure sanctions, which it imposed on Iran after the former pulled out of the JCPOA, and give guarantees that a future administration will not ditch the deal again. Now, Iran's top security chief said that there is no coherence coming from the U.S. on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Ali Shamkhani has stressed that the U.S. administration cannot impose the cost of its internal disputes on Iran.
And I think that now what we are witnessing is a division internally in the United States in the political establishment, both Democrats and Republicans, regarding a resolution to the ongoing situation with Iran regarding whether to go back to the table and to rejoin the JCPOA. We know that Biden has made overtures, and the State Department has said that they would grant some concessions in the forms of sanctions waivers. But like many Iranian commentators and politicians and diplomats have said, it doesn't go far enough.
Voices from the U.S. government show that there is no coherence in the country to make political decisions in the direction of advancements in the Vienna talks. The U.S. administration cannot pay for its internal disputes by violating Iran's legal rights. And voice from Iran and the P4 plus one group of countries, Britain, France, Russia, and China plus Germany, have been holding negotiations in the Austrian capital for 10 months in a bid to resurrect the JCPOA.
And I think that there's not much appetite for a deal with Iran at this point. I think the Trump administration did tremendous damage to the JCPOA by removing itself from it.
The new round of talks comes amid rising hawkish voices in the U.S. A group of 33 U.S. Republican senators, led by Senator Ted Cruz, wrote a letter to President Biden warning him that any deal with Iran on restoring the JCPOA requires Senate approval. The senators warned Biden that they will do everything in their power to block a possible deal if he moves forward without them. They also said that the implementation of any agreement will be severely, if not terminally, hampered if the Biden administration does not fulfill a range of obligations in relation to congressional oversight over any agreements. The Republican senators said that if there is a deal that does not have Senate approval, it would be subject to being reversed as soon as there is a new president.
We see that the United States has been belligerent and has continued to put what it calls a maximum pressure campaign on the Iranian people, on the Iranian state, on the legal and legitimate Iranian government. And we see it as a web of coordinated activities by which we also know that Israel and the Zionist lobby are also pushing very heavily in the United States, in Washington.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. The pressure campaign was led by the Israeli and Arab lobby groups in the U.S. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it is willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage.
So I think that the internal divisions in the United States politically will continue to give free rein to the national security state in the United States to continue to put maximum pressure on Iran. But we know very well that Iran is a sovereign country, and it will defend itself.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the onus falls on the U.S. to remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic in a verifiable manner and guarantee that a new U.S. administration would not breach the JCPOA again.
neither East nor West, Islamic Republic. This famous slogan summarizes Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution and the people's fervent opposition to Cold War rivals, the United States and the Soviet Union, the two powers that then polarized the world sharply along the East-West divide. The slogan, which later became the Iranian foreign policy motto, was inspired by the ideas of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, who blamed the two powers for many problems faced by Iran and the Islamic world. He believed Muslims should reject the influence of both capitalism and communism. At the onset of the Islamic Revolution, many Iranians were tired of exploitation that culminated into Iran's losing big chunks of its territory to other countries. Therefore, the revolution kindled their hopes of independence and liberty. Iran's occupation by British and Russian empires in two world wars and the country's economic exploitation, directly or indirectly, were still fresh in the collective memory of Iranians. Also etched into people's psyche was how the US and Britain engrossed their democratic aspirations in 1953 by orchestrating a coup against a popular government and returning the autocratic Shah to the throne. That coup consolidated the West's imperialistic agenda over Iran for a quarter of a century. In the 1970s, the Pahlavi regime was cheered by then-US President Richard Nixon as one of, quote, America's cops on the beat in the Middle East for helping steer the oil-rich region away from the Soviet influence. In those days, the Pahlavi regime even obeyed the U.S. request to support its much-criticized war in Vietnam, sending warplanes, hosting American forces, and refueling warplanes. Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State under Nixon, admitted following the 1979 revolution that the Shah never failed to stand by the U.S. He described him as a man whom seven American presidents had lauded as a loyal ally. It was certainly a big blow for Washington to see the Shah ousted. The newly established Islamic Republic viewed both the U.S. and the Soviet Union as miscellaneous forces in international politics. The U.S. was referred to as the Great Satan, since it was the main backer of the Shah and posed the most immediate danger to the revolution. And the Soviet Union was regarded as the lesser Satan, since it was not seen as closely involved with the Iranian monarchy as the U.S. The most dramatic symbol of the revolutionary determination to assert independence was the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in November 1979 by a number of students. Angered by the U.S. admission of Shah, they asked Washington to hand over the former despot, a request that was never met. Iran's relations with the Soviet Union and its allies were tense as well, although at a low intensity. Tehran was opposed to numerous Soviet international policies, particularly its invasion of Afghanistan. In 1988, Imam Khomeini sent a letter to then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev warning him of an immediate danger. That letter has gone down in history as insightful and prophetic, from the leader of an independent nation to a superpower.
If you hope at this juncture to solve the economic problems of socialism and communism by appealing to the centers of the Western capitalism, you will, far from remedying any ill of your society, commit a mistake which those to come will have to erase.
The post-revolutionary Iran has now consolidated itself regionally and globally, forming warm relations with independent countries across the board. With the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Iran also pursued a look to the East policy, engaging in close collaboration with Russia and China. The independent Iran is now being regarded as a power that has contributed a lot to make the West Asian region more stable and peaceful. One such instance is Iran's role in defeating Daesh terrorism in Iraq, Syria, and beyond. Undoubtedly, Iran's Islamic Revolution was one of the biggest social upheavals of the 20th century. 43 years on, Imam Khomeini's words still resonate, and his powerful ideas of liberation from imperialistic domination, independence in domestic and foreign affairs, as well as call for embracing social justice and harmony continue to inspire not only Iranians, but people in the region and beyond.
ت
Tensions between the West and Russia remain high, with the United States and its allies accusing Moscow of planning an invasion on its Western neighbor, Ukraine, and Russia denying all the accusations. The tensions are already starting to hurt Europe, which is largely dependent on Russian gas. The threats of sanctions on Russia are raising fears about a possible disruption of supply and demand in the energy market. There have been other factors at play too. The cold winter, low gas storage levels, high European Union carbon prices, fewer liquefied natural gas tanker deliveries due to higher demand from Asia, lower than normal Russian gas supplies, and infrastructure outages are all cited as reasons why the continent is facing a potential energy crisis.
The crisis which we have is in part self-made by the European Union because they have allowed their storages to run pretty empty in winter time. This is crazy. And there's another story from the EU side, which is unprecedented, I think, in world's history, that there's a double pipeline brand new, ready to deliver on Germany's shores, coming directly from Russia. And we are refusing to use that second double pipeline.
That explains rising energy prices across the continent, with benchmark European gas prices at the Dutch TTF hub rising by 330% last year, while benchmark German and French power contracts have more than doubled. The United Kingdom is facing a rise in inflation at rates not seen in the past three decades. A major retail company is now warning that the worst is yet to come. Britain's biggest retailer, Tesco, says the prices of its products can go up to as much as 5% in the months to come. The company blames the matter on the rise in energy bills. Last week, the Bank of England raised interest rates for the second time in 3 months after forecasting that the peak inflation will reach a record 7% in April. What the European countries can't deny is that they need Russian gas. Take Germany, for example, which is expecting the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project to become operational. The pipeline would potentially supply 26 million German households. But the United States might be the one to prevent that from happening.
The notion that Nord Stream 2 would go forward with an invasion by the Russians is just not going to happen.
This is the situation, and it's Europe which is not, you know, trying to make a good connection with Russia and see to it that Nord Stream 2 starts producing, starts delivering. This is the situation. It's a crazy situation. And I think there is no situation like this in human history that the goods are ready, but the victim refuses the goods because there's a stronger guy behind, like Washington, like the US, stopping us.
The US has been warning of what it calls an imminent Russian attack on Ukraine, despite Ukrainian officials' statements that suggest the contrary. Some NATO members are reluctantly backing Washington on this. But the Europeans are the ones who will have to bear the consequences of any conflict or tension on the continent and not the US. Then, diplomacy and dialogue seem to be the only feasible options between the two sides, as further tensions won't be in anyone's interest.
In the limelight.
The Islamic Revolution and its ideals are indeed undefeatable, no matter the gravity of the plots of the devilish powers, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Grand Display of People's Support in Revolution Rallies. Stay tuned for more. We'll be right back.
If rains and snowfall had not stopped millions of Iranians from marching on the streets every year on February 11th, nationwide, to celebrate the climax of the 10-day dawn that marks the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, their fervor of the past 2 years on this auspicious occasion to triumph over a pandemic that has paralyzed the world is indeed further proof of their indomitable spirit. This unassailable spirit, which for the past 43 years has weathered an 8-year war and defeated the unabated U.S. sanctions, economic terrorism, was on full display in Tehran and throughout the country as the nation marked yet another glorious anniversary of the emergence of Iran from decades of domestic despotism and foreign hegemony. In observance of the health and hygienic guidelines because of the coronavirus, in most towns and cities, it were rallies of cars and motorcycles as well as trucks, but this did not deter many to come out on foot, flashing victory gains, waving the national flag, holding posters of the father of the Islamic Revolution and of the present leader of the Islamic Revolution, along with those of martyr Qasem Soleimani. And of course, making a bonfire of the emblems of those two most hated symbols of oppression and terrorism, that is the U.S. and Zionist entity. The joyous mood of the million-strong Iranian masses is indeed a resounding slap on the face of the great Satan and its minions, whose intricate plots have been foiled time and again. In the capital, jubilant Iranians converged on Azadi Square from all directions to renew allegiance to the Islamic Republic system of government and its refusal to bow to blackmail. The communique read at the end of the rally emphasized Iran's independence and progress. It also called for the withdrawal of all CENTCOM terrorists from neighboring Iraq and the entire West Asia region, with expression of full support to the Palestinian struggle for liberation of their homeland, as well as for nations fighting invaders and terrorists. As testimony to the grassroots support of the Iranian people to the revolution, President Dr. Seyed Ebrahim Raisi, in his speech at the Friday prayer gathering at Tehran's sprawling Imam Khomeini Musalla, made it clear that the Islamic Republic counts on itself for its stability and progress, without any trust in talks and those who have a record of breaking promises. He said, "We have faith in God Almighty and full reliance on the people and resources of Khuzestan, Khorasan, Azerbaijan provinces, the east, west, and south of our country, but we never have expectations in the results of talks in Vienna or New York." This aptly sums up Iran's policy of balanced relations with the international community on the basis of reciprocal respect and firm opposition to the hegemons and their clients who destabilize regional peace and the world order. The Islamic Revolution and its ideals are indeed undefeatable, no matter the gravity of the plots of the devilish powers.
This is A to Z,